Hi dear folks at Movie Breaks, here I am still at Tallinn Black Nights Film Festival, this time with another exciting film, Who's That's Running In competition, and I'm here with director Jerome Yu. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. We just talked already how we arrived and how different this festival is from other festivals. And for you, it's also a special experience, I suppose, because you're now here as a director, but you started out filming as an actor.
That's right. It's special because I have been directing short films for a while, but coming from an actor and now here with my first feature film at Tallinn Black Nights in the first feature competition, it's quite a special moment.
Yeah, they have a number of competitions at Tallinn. We maybe should have mentioned that. So it's really like four or five competition sections, I think. And yours is your like director debut. It's called Mongrels, and it also is a very personal story because you are Korean-Canadian. Mm-hmm. You grew up in Canada, but you have like an immigrant background from your parents. And this is also the family structure that we see in the film. We have a young male main character who lives after the death of the mother with his little sister and his father in Canada and tries to adjust to this new surroundings and also the new family situation.
That's right.
Yeah, how did you find that story?
It's very personal, of course. I find that it's personal, but it is still very fiction, so I cannot say that the film represents exactly what has happened, you know, in my life. But I think in nuance and, you know, small layers and colors, there's a lot of influence from my life. A lot of it feels like a tribute to my entire life in Canada of my family story, my story. I think that's why it is my first feature film, because it feels like what's most personal is maybe, hopefully, most relatable.
And do you also see like yourself in the main character? Because of course it's tempting to make that connection.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I find that maybe once upon a time I was that character. You know, there's definitely like layers in there where I believe there's questions that I've asked in my upbringing of certain curiosities that I've had towards my friendships, whether it be my relationships with family, how I perceive others, that I think is colored within the film. A lot of it is hypothetical too, of course, of certain things that I don't think I ever got to fully examine or explore in my youth, or the time of great curiosity, I would like to say. So this is a long way to say, yes, of course, there's definitely parts that I see in each of these characters, actually.
An important element of the story is that the characters are all in their own way alone with their pain, so they cannot really talk to each other or don't know how to communicate with each other. How did you develop that, and where does that come from?
That's a really good question. I find that I structured the film in a way that's very specifically catered towards each character. It almost feels like one specific chapter is, you know, very much trying to portray and paint a single character. And because they're all dealing with their own trials and tribulations and challenges, they're all taking in grief in different ways. I think I wanted to hyper-focus it on a single character rather than interacting too much. But that's not to say I find that everyone is so drunken in their grief and how they're navigating it in their own ways that I find that naturally maybe it is that interaction is limited and they are truly, living in their own world.
This film has a three-part structure. So as you said, each character has their own chapter, and we also have the final chapter of the little girl, which is very different from the chapter that the first one that the father has, which is much darker, almost like a criminal film. And how did you make those opposites, where you like those very opposite moods, where you ever worried that they might not work together?
I never questioned whether it might not work. I think as a, you know, an audience member, a consumer of film, I'm always hoping that there's a new exciting approaches, and I think, you know, something that I didn't think so much about it. Maybe it's just me being naive a little bit about how tone would be perceived, or if maybe some audience members might find it jarring. But for me, it was very clear that each character would have its own tone at times. But also, it was very clear to me that I wanted to open up the tone as the runtime went longer. So from the first chapter, it is the darkest in some ways. And it is very with a purposeful intent that the last chapter, it's much airier, dreamier, lighter, in hopes to open up another perspective of what the father is going through versus what the daughter is going through, and something in between with the son as well.
And we have also this very interesting motive of the dogs, the titular mongrels. Those are like stray dogs, they're roaming the area and they're hunted, and especially the son, but both kids actually feel sorry for the dogs, which the father, as like a side occupation, hunts down and kills. So where did you, is it also something from your own youth, or did you completely make that up, or is that something that happens in Canada, that you have a lot of stray dogs?
There's a lot of stray dogs. I wouldn't, you know, a little bit around the world. There was a little instance, you know, in Korea and Jeju Island. I also understand that stray dog and wild dog issues happen in a bunch of different prairie lands around the world, where they can destroy farmers' crops or livestock, things like that, where it's become such a nuisance or a troubling situation where hunters would actually have to, you know, go out and call, you know, the these stray dog problems. So I recall there was a news sort of article that I came across, I think Twitter at the time, where that kind of sparked the idea of, oh, that's quite an interesting background. Because growing up in Canada, I found that with the rise of YouTube, actually, one of the most viral videos, one of the first viral videos on YouTube was something along the lines of Korean people's relationship with dogs, and maybe how they eat dog meat, or all these sort of, you know, forbidden ideas, where I think Korea were, once upon a time, it is true, you know, they did consume dog meat. It was a developing, you know, country, and, you know, when the country was very poor coming out of the war, I think that's what the people resorted to. But it's been a very complicated relationship that I was questioned on when I was much younger, in elementary school. And I think it was the first time where I was kind of pushed back on my relationship with my race, even though I grew up very Canadian. So it's been a bit of an interesting topic for me, which I connected the wild dog to kind of this hypothetical question of, you know, a Korean family's a relationship with like dogs at the time, and kind of bringing it all together, where we clearly see that even the father has empathy for these dogs, but he feels very torn and conflicted, where for the sake of survival he must do this deed of having to hunt down these creatures, right? You know, I like to believe that the father is he does have empathy for these creatures, and is very conflicted himself of why he must stain his hands with blood, you know, for the sake of survival, for his own survival and his family.
We also have a certain connection between the family and the dogs themselves, because the family, even though they're within the confines of middle-class society outwardly, they're still kind of on the fringes and not fully accepted and seen as still as outsiders within a certain frame who are tolerated, but there's always often this feeling that as soon as you make some mistake, it will hit you much harder than it would maybe hit like a white or Caucasian person.
Yes.
Or somebody who's always been a member of the community. There's also this idea often with communities of the stranger, like somebody who has moved in latest and is the outsider. And it's very hard to become ever really a part of the community.
Yes. And in, just as you said, in this idea, you know, the title Mongrels, it struck me from the very beginning, almost before I even had the script in mind, because I think that is the image that I saw symbolic to this family, you know, outsiders. Mongrels also means dogs that are of two different types of blood and of background. So then to me, this family that doesn't fit in here nor there, you know, trying to search for a place of belonging, a sense of community. It felt like this is the right title to capture a lot of different things in the film.
Yeah, it's certainly very multi-layered. And speaking of multi-layered, you also have this very interesting style. We have a realist approach, and it's a story that's like a sociodrama or a family drama, but there are also sometimes those Yakanota's magic realist elements or scenes that almost feel like fantasy, even though nothing really supernatural happens in them. Where does that mood come from? It's very engrossing.
Thank you. I think since a young age, I find myself absorbed with myths and legends and folk tales. One particular folk tale that I, you know, further ingrained into this film is the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin. You know, the Pied Piper of Hamelin, the story quickly goes that it's an outsider comes into a rat-infested and plagued town.
Oh yeah, it's and German, yeah, we know it, that. It,
of course, and, you know, playing the flute is able to take these rats away, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, maybe if you see the film, you'll be able to see how it's related and mirrored in that sense as well. But I think it's this obsession that I have that I try to, you know, maybe no one will ever be able to tell whether, you know, if it was from this spark of an idea or not, but I like to layer these things in. But also, as I grow older in age these days, I find that more and more, as an adult's perception becomes black and white, and the magic in our world kind of starts to slowly disappear. And I think I was most fascinated with the last chapter when it comes to that innocent and naive lens of the world, how magic can still exist and how they can still follow that thread of imagination and exploration, curiosity, and it still being real for them. And perhaps I wanted to capture that moment where that naive lens is broken and shattered ever so slightly. And just within trying to explore that, I think the original question that you asked was how I tried to layer it in, I guess. I think through just the three different very distinct lens of gaze that these characters have of the world, I think just very naturally with my own taste and obsession and the youngest character being a child that's just in between that dream and reality of two worlds, I think it just naturally kind of gave voice to this sort of stylistic choice.
And how did you find the actors for those roles, especially since they have so many personal aspects?
This can go for a long while, are you sure?
yeah, we still have time, so you can talk.
Okay, casting started in Canada, nationwide search, because I come from acting, you know. I'm Korean, so I am very familiar with the pool of actors, Korean actors, in Canada. And I knew that it would come out empty. So I took my search to Korea after we did a nationwide search, came out empty of professional actors. For The Sun, we saw about 100, you know, teenagers in Korea. I think it's a thriving entertainment market. There's a lot of up-and-coming just kids that are wanting to become actors, wanting to become K-pop stars because that industry is booming so much. Long time ago, I think entertainment field was looked down upon, you know, because coming from a very specific Asian background, I think, you know, your parents want you to become doctors, lawyers
and all those respectable
jobs, right? And now because of how much respect Korean cinema has gotten, K-pop has gotten, sort of the entertainment industry has gotten, I feel like there's this huge, almost competitive pool of up-and-coming youth that are wanting to enter that industry. So this is all to say, the actor that I ended up casting, Ho Young for The Sun, he's actually a former K-pop trainee that is now an actor, and out of many, many different auditions, he's actually the only actor that I found in the audition room. The father was much more complicated because the father, who is played by Jaehyun Kim, I saw many actors in the audition room, but no one quite felt like the image I had of this actor that played the dad is of a cornered wild animal that's just very tired and exhausted, almost broken. And I couldn't quite find this animalistic essence from anybody in the room. And I was in discussion with this one actually quite well-known actor in Korea that was interested in the role. As we were talking, deep down I felt like maybe he isn't quite right for the part, but then he ended up telling me when he read the script, the first actor he thought of that came to his mind. And then he showed me a photo, and instantly I felt like, oh, this is him, you know? So then I had to play a bit of this back and forth game of, you know, I'm interested in the actor he mentioned, but, you know, he's also interested in the part. But this actor he mentioned, it's also quite a fascinating circumstance because he had retired from acting. He left to the countryside, far away from the capital city of Seoul, because he was very hurt by the industry. So there was no way to reach him because he lived this very like a technology-free life, actually, you know, that is, doesn't know how to take a video call or, you know, like doesn't really get connected to Wi-Fi easily.
You have to write a letter.
Yes, exactly. So I actually had to ask the actor eventually to help me get into contact with them. And then my associate producer had to drive out about 2 hours out into the countryside to get me on a video call with Jaehyun. And after a lengthy conversation, no audition, I just offered him the part, and yeah, he ended up taking that part. So that's the father, the son, and finally the daughter. We street casting. We kind of put it into Korean communities for, you know, younger adolescent girls that might be interested in an experience like this. Funny story is that someone actually had submitted a photo of themselves to audition for the role of the father back in Canada in Vancouver. And it was a family photo because they're not professionals. And he was, you know, wanting to audition for the dad. But then in the photo, there was a little girl. And I instantly saw her and I'm like, I need to see her instead of the father. And
that's tough.
Long story short, she had the most beautiful eyes. Something about her eyes, she had never acted before in her life. But I think it was her courage because she didn't audition, but the for a random video that was sent my way was her doing karate. And just the toughness, the softness in the gaze of her eyes where, you know, it felt like an audience could just paint whatever emotion, you know, she's feeling by themselves. It's quite strange. Maybe you feel the same way or maybe you don't, but I just felt like her eyes were so deep, you know.
Yeah, she's great. Like, she's really like a natural. I think it's some kids, they just have that aura.
Yes.
And it feels like they're very easy connect to different emotions.
Mm-hmm. And Sein Jin, who is the actress that plays the role of Hannah, she was just so wonderful to work with. No one could believe that this was her first time acting. And even the way she was on set, she was just nothing but professional. And I'm sure she has a very prosperous career lined up ahead, a bright future ahead of her.
And now you talked about the acting with the kids and you said it was very easy, but there's also all the animals. And there's, you know, that saying, never work with animals.
Oh, gosh.
How was that? Especially since most of them seem to be like real dogs. So they're not like...
They were real dogs.
We use a
you
lot
know?
Of CGI animals these days, but
yes,
those are
yes.
like real dogs.
No, you know, we're very low budget independent film, and oh gosh, the most of the budget went into this one day where it was the climax of, you know, having all the dogs on set, 14 dogs on set, you know, and you do everything that you possibly can with the animal trainers and the dog wranglers to have some of the actions and the behavior that we want to film planned out and rehearsed beforehand. So we had two other rehearsal days outside of set with these dogs, and we finally got it. We come to set, and for these dogs, it's a new environment, open forest, and it's everything so exciting. There's, you know, 50 crew members and all of this. So then we couldn't get anything that we wanted. It was like quite, you know, just simply put, frustrating, you know. There's a saying that you don't want to work with children, you know, in your first feature.
Yeah.
You don't want to work with animals. And I broke both those laws, and I'm very, I feel very lucky that I was able to find something in the edit to make it work, hopefully. But I will, you know, I will admit the dogs were incredibly challenging. I don't know if I'll ever want 14 dogs on set, maybe up to 3 or 4 at most. But lessons learned, and I think even the fact that maybe it's me being naive, my team, we're very young, so us being naive, of us just being able to have this dream of let's have 14 docs on set and try to create this like really big thing, you know, of our climax. You know, we're young, we're hungry filmmakers, and we just want to, you know, bring this dream to life. And I feel like that's how we got there. And then it was a reality check of just like, no, this is like,
this is chaos. Yeah,
this is chaos, exactly. But, you know, all in all, it was really fun, you know. Everyone loved Dogs on Set, including myself, so we were just happy, and like, you know, sometimes the stress levels were maintained just because we could pet these dogs, beautiful dogs, and, you know, it was a fantastic experience.
And now that you have that first feature here, how do you feel being in Tallinn? At it's like one of the most prestigious festivals in the Baltics, and it's also an important A-list festival worldwide. So how does that feel?
Oh, it's an incredible honor. I almost just I jumped up and down, like, you know, almost screaming with just how happy and ecstatic I was when I got the official invitation letter, as was my team, just so happy and grateful to be here. For myself, I think taking your first debut feature on a festival, you know, film festival path, just to see where it aligns, you know. I think it feels like a rite of passage, right, for every new filmmaker. And the fact that I feel like Tallinn Black Knights felt like this is a film that resonated with them and aligned with them, I feel just very appreciative. And I hope that I could call this festival a home I could bring all my future films to in the many coming years of my career.
Especially since they have this trophy, which also looks like it's a wolf, basically.
I know,
but
right?
Kind of,
I know.
It feels like very, very fitting.
Yeah.
Because it could also be a dog in the way it looks, you know?
No, absolutely. So, you know, in the sort of same, you know, the wolf is kind of the big symbol and logo for Tallinn Black Knights. And, you know, I can relate to that with my films. So hopefully it bodes well.
Yeah, it would be like, yeah, come on, we put the 14 dogs in it. Just give us the trophy.
I know. It would be amazing, of course. But again, just Tallinn Black Knights, my team is incredibly happy to be here, and it's really a dream come true.
And do you already have ideas for a new project? It's always kind of a difficult question if you just finish something and everybody's like, and what's the next one? But is there already something growing?
It is. There's a couple things growing, but right now it's all just that first little speck of an idea where I'm trying to figure out which path I go to. But I'm thinking right now, and I'm trying to write my second feature. And hopefully I can be on set again soon.
And would that also be a dramatic feature, or maybe more something that goes into a fantasy or surreal direction?
More surreal. I think I would like to bring it to more surreal. Hopefully higher budget, which allows me to play a little bit more. And I think I love drama, but, you know, sometimes I feel like you know, drama can feel really grounded and rooted in reality, but to mix that up and blend it with something that's surreal and dreamlike and a bit of a fantasy, I think leads to something quite special.
And just as a final question, what do you hope will the international audience take away from your film if they watch them?
This is a tough question.
Yeah, or maybe apart from like liking it or feeling entertained, but
yeah,
on a personal level.
Number one, I hope they like it or find something in it for themselves. But I think something along the lines of, I think I only realized this after the film was made and done. It's not that I decided to explore grief, but I realized that at the center of this whole story, despite all the different experiences these characters have and their own challenges that they have, it is grief that they're navigating. And what I would hope to leave the audience is, at the end of the long heart tunnel of cruel grief can lie hope and lightness and hope, love, you know, something like that.
That's certainly a perfect closing statement. Thank you so much, Jerome Yu, for the interview. And Mongrels is still at Tallinn Black Nights Film Festival. I'm sure it sooner or later will get a German release as well. So if it does, we tell you about it at Movie Break. And until then, you can read my festival review. I'm Lida and say stay tuned and goodbye, folks. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope that was okay.
Yeah, that was really great stuff.